I met Matt there because I was there. Like, so I found out about it, went right after a soccer game with my three kids in all my soccer gear. And I recorded the whole thing, of course. And then Matt came up to me because he was also recording the whole thing. And he said, hey, there's this... Are you interested in autonomous vehicles? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, there's this group meeting on Wednesday night. I said, oh, wait, really? And then I said, wait a minute. He said, yeah, it's about energy use of autonomous vehicles. I said, wait, that's my event. And so I thought that was kind of not super coincidental because it was an autonomous vehicle event, but glad that I got to meet Matt and glad that you can make it, and especially glad that Jeff could be here with us tonight. So I've actually known Jeff for nearly 2 years, and he has. We've talked a little bit about the research that he'd been doing, and we knew this was coming, that his paper was going to get published, and was really excited to get him to be willing to come down and present to you guys. So he originally PhD from Berkeley, also spent some time at Princeton, some time at Google, and at NASA Ames in various roles. So if you could please give a round of applause for Jeff Greenblatt.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be giving a talk here. I thought that this would be published some time ago and that I could give this talk last year, but you know what? It's a much better piece of analysis now. As you know, going through the peer review process, you inevitably think of things that you should have addressed or that they tell you have to address. So anyway, I'm really pleased for the honor to present. And this is my first public talk on this topic, by the way, since the paper has become published. So I hope the talk doesn't stumble along too much, but we'll have some fun tonight. So I'm going to talk to you about so I'm an energy researcher, and really most of my focus is on greenhouse gas reduction strategies from the local level, like I'm working with the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, all the way to the global. Autonomous vehicles generally caught my attention about 2 years ago when I connected with Greg, and since then we've focused on this interesting category of autonomous vehicles. We've coined autonomous taxis. You can call them other things too, but that's what I want to tell you about tonight, because I think the implications of shared autonomous vehicles are quite important. So this was published in Nature Climate Change last Monday, so it's very new. Unfortunately, it is not public access. You can read the abstract, but if you want the whole thing, you would have to pay if you're not a subscriber. But please send me an email if you'd like to read it. I'm happy to share it sort of one-on-one. That's totally fine. I'll send you the PDF and all the supporting if you're interested. I'm going to start with kind of the bottom line. I know that's the style these days. What am I ultimately going to conclude? The greenhouse gas emissions from autonomous taxis could be more than 90% lower per mile than standard vehicles today. And they might also be cheaper than current taxis to operate by quite a bit. So these are provocative claims, but that's why we felt it was important to publish this paper, and I'll try to walk you through and convince you that this is a real effect. We're focusing on fully autonomous taxis, so not what would probably be coming out right away, but in a few years' time, and we're sort of aiming for the year 2030, more or less. I mean, that's our target year for modeling. So this is a level 4 or 5 for people who know the lingo. It's essentially a car that the person does not have to drive at all, and as you can see in this picture here that an artist drew for me, you know, the person's probably focused on other tasks. So what is an autonomous taxi? Well, it's a robot and a cab put together. And what happens when you do that? So did anybody recognize that person? You see the movie? Ex Machina? I thought she would be our little emblem for today, so you'll see her again. So autonomous taxis are basically just a shared autonomous vehicle. Instead of privately owning them, as more than 96% of the vehicles on the roads in America today are, what if they were shared? What happens when we do that? Well, you can kind of think of it as half Zipcar, which is where you rent a car yourself and drive it yourself, and half Uber, where somebody is driving you, but it's still an on-demand kind of thing. But there's a robot in charge, okay? So what? What does that do? Well, it turns out that it does some pretty important things. The main thing that we found early on in this research is has to do with the number of miles that a taxi travels versus a regular vehicle. So taxis, I learned after I got into this, travel between 40 and 70,000 miles a year. And actually, the one data point I have for San Francisco is 90,000 miles. I don't know how rigorously these numbers are backed up, but I believe it that they travel a heck of a lot further than our cars do. So the average U.S. privately owned vehicle is about 12,000, maybe 12.5. Newer cars drive a little further, older cars less, but it's 12 sort of on a per capita, you know, per vehicle owner basis. So as a result, this means that an efficient vehicle is going to be much more economical when it's driven frequently. And the reason a more efficient vehicle doesn't cost as much to operate, it might cost more up front. And so if you drive it more, then your cost savings magnify. You know, taxi owners already know this. What I also learned recently is that unlike like the mid 2000s, when almost all of the taxis in New York City looked like this, the Ford Crown Victoria, now more than 60% of the taxis are hybrids of one kind or another. So people are figuring this out fast, and I think eventually we'll be seeing electric taxis on the roads as the battery range and other factors improve a little. So let's get into economics a little bit, just to prove that this is really a big effect. What is a vehicle's total cost of ownership? There are a lot of other things here too, but I've broken it into three main categories: capital, cost of buying the vehicle, the fuel, and then maintenance and insurance. And I've modeled both of these, or all three of these, as on a per mile basis. To give an example, you sort of have your normal like $25,000 new car that you finance over 5 years. You add some interest to that, you're paying roughly $500 a month, or about $6,000 a year for that. Fuel costs, maybe about $2,400, and a little bit less for maintenance and insurance. And voila, there's your total cost of ownership on an annualized basis. Okay. Now, what happens? Okay, so about $9,600 a year for a new car. Now, what happens if that same car now travels 70,000 miles a year instead of 12? Well, the cost of the capital is the same, still the same car, still paying for it over 5 years. But now your fuel bill is about six times higher, and you got to get it serviced more frequently. You know, the insurance company would be alarmed to find out how many miles you put on it, so they're going to charge you more. So that goes way up too. And now you're looking at something like $28,000 a year. So then the question is, but what if that vehicle were now more efficient? And just a simple example, and these are just kind of out of the blue that I've taken this, but I think it's roughly accurate. So now let's say that the car costs an extra $5,000 in order to get double the efficiency. Okay, does that sound reasonable? Maybe even conservative, like a hybrid or something. So now the capital goes up per year a little bit, about $1,000 extra a year. Fuel drops by half. This is the same. So now you've got a huge savings. Obviously, it costs more than the privately owned vehicle because you're driving it further, but it's a huge cost savings. So you see that there's a crossover point where economics pushes you toward the more efficient end of the spectrum. And what we were surprised at is how quickly that became the case for a battery electric vehicle, even with today's costs. So what I'm going to show you now briefly is comparing four technologies. This is all data based on a National Academy study from 2013. So we've got and I'm just introducing some lingo here so you don't get confused. We've got our standard internal combustion engine vehicle. We've got a hybrid electric vehicle like the Prius. This is gasoline driven, not a plug-in electric. We've got a fuel cell vehicle, which was also in the data, and so we decided to look at that too, though the cost of hydrogen is much less well known than the cost of either electricity or gasoline. And then finally, a battery electric vehicle. And we put in the capital costs and the efficiency numbers for all of these things and the current and future costs of the fuels. And this is what we came up with. So this is a bit of a busy graph, so I'm just going to sort of highlight what's going on here. This is essentially as a function of the annual number of miles driven for each of these four vehicles, and the color code is the same as what I showed. This is the total cost of ownership. So down here, where it's at 12,000 miles a year, the least efficient vehicle, the ICEV, is also the cheapest, as we would expect. That's why most of us buy these cars, and we don't buy these as much as some of us might like to buy a battery electric. It's just too costly if you only drive it that far in a year. But if you now drive it 70,000 miles a year, then the most efficient vehicle becomes the cheapest. You can see that the crossover point happens fairly late in this game. So if you're only driving it like 30 or 40,000 miles, it's kind of a toss-up. Actually, the hybrid quickly becomes the more efficient one. This is with 2014 data, so this is kind of where things are right now. But if we then look forward to 2030, again, using this data from National Academies, the picture gets even better for the efficient end of the spectrum. So now I've got the original data here from 2014, but I've superimposed on it how the prices of all these things are going to fall. So two things are happening. The cost of the vehicles themselves are falling, and then the slopes are going down, which means that they're getting a little more efficient. As a result, when I put all this together, now the battery electrics become the more efficient, even at 30,000 miles per year. Okay, and again, this assumes the certain cost for electricity and so on, and there's some uncertainty in that, but we've looked at the sensitivities. There's a very robust result. Certainly by the time you get to 70,000 miles, this is by far the cheapest vehicle you can run. So, because of this, we've kind of concluded that autonomous vehicles are going to be electric. And isn't that cool? Because electricity is also a lower carbon energy source than gasoline. Not to mention that it's, in principle, renewable and all of that. So that further lowers the carbon footprint of this taxi versus that of a gasoline engine. It's not just more efficient, but it's a lower carbon energy source. Let's just quickly compare the carbon intensity, the greenhouse gas intensity of these fuels. So what we did is we looked at these four vehicle technologies again, ICEV, HEV, and then we superimposed some various future predictions for what the carbon intensity is going to be. Now, there's a lot going on here. Basically, what I want to focus your attention on is here is today's prediction using Energy Information Administration. This is from the Department of Energy for 2014. This is what the per mile greenhouse gas emissions would be if you drove each of these four vehicles. And here, the fuel cell vehicle, we're assuming that you're making this from natural gas. So you're doing natural gas reforming to make hydrogen, okay? And you can see that it goes down as you increase the, as you progress across here and the efficiency is higher.
These are equivalent weight vehicles?
These are all sort of a standard light-duty vehicle, so it's an average of passenger vehicle. And thank you, Brad. Tomorrow, in 2030, we're now using the same information, and all these numbers are lower. And the reason it's lower is not because the gasoline has gotten a lot cleaner, but because the vehicles are more efficient. So a 2030 ICEV is now roughly half the carbon emissions per mile as it was last year. Hybrid electric's also more efficient. A little less efficiency improvement on the fuel cell and electric side, but you can see that things are still going down. But also, the electricity is getting a little cleaner than it is today, but not very much, because this is a very conservative assumption. But then we look at two other things, which is, all right, well, what if the EPA's Clean Power Plan law changes, goes into effect, which is another basically a 30% reduction on U.S. electricity. Well, in that case, then you have this small reduction here. I guess it's a little less than 30% how I've modeled it. And here this goes up because I've switched from making the hydrogen from natural gas to making it from electricity. And it's actually not that efficient to do, and so the carbon intensity goes up. But that's not what we're going to focus on here. Finally, I wanted to look at what's going on in California. You can't see this, but this is where California's grid could be in 2030. And if that were used for these vehicles, you could get another sizable reduction. Overall, it's about a 50% reduction from where we were in the conservative assumption. So you get another factor of two by going to a clean grid like we might have in California. That's the take-home message here. And overall, compared to an ICEV car driven today, you're looking at about a 90% lower emissions per mile. Okay? And they're cheaper. But that's not all. There's a whole other part of this which the autonomous technology enables. All right. So most trips in the U.S. are taken alone or with one other person. Does anybody have an idea of what percentage of trips are taken with one person in them? This is on a per mile, on a total miles basis. Want to wager a guess?
70, 80%.
70, 80%? You know already. You've done the research. Anyone else? Guesses?
90.
Now you guys are pessimists. No, it isn't that high. I'll show you. So one-person trips are about 62% of total U.S. vehicle miles traveled. Two people make up another 25%, and three or more are about 13%. This is not just commuting trips. This is all trips. So that tells you that if we could deploy these vehicles by the trip, most of them could be serving only one or two people at a time and could be a lot smaller. So we looked at that. Smaller vehicles consume less energy. They also cost less to operate. So what's not to like about that if a person is just using the vehicle for a few minutes at a time? So we did some calculations, and this is where the actual kind of mechanics of the study were. We did some autonomy simulations, which is a Argonne National Laboratory tool that allows you to simulate vehicles with various loads and driving patterns, air resistance, weight, etc. And taking a Nissan Leaf and essentially shrinking it down, cutting it almost in half in width. The width is really important because it reduces the aerodynamic drag considerably and reducing other things proportionately, power and so on. A one-person vehicle would get about 45, it would use about 45, 47, I should be precise, 47% of the energy use of an average light-duty vehicle. A little bit more for a two-person vehicle because it's larger and heavier, but would still be a half-width vehicle. And then we just kind of assumed averages for the rest of the fleet. So this is just like a normal passenger sedan. This is a slightly larger light-duty vehicle average, so it could be a small SUV. And then for the largest category, which only represents 1% of total miles traveled, we kind of assumed like a large minivan. And that pretty much covers most of the needs of U.S. trips. On average, when you put all this together and weight it by the number of trips taken, we get a reduction of almost 50% in the average energy use from vehicles. So that's another factor of two. So I just wanted to show this because I have a vision of how this could go. So you take your phone app and you say, I've got a couple of suitcases and I'm on my way to the airport, so I'm going to need, I don't know, a 1A car might be a little too small. I'll take a 1B, and you call up a 1B and it comes. And it's designed to have a little more luggage space. Or maybe you've got a lot of packages, but you're just one person, so then you ask for 1C, or so on. Or there's two of you, and so now, you know, 2A or 2, you get the idea. So the idea is it's very customized. You can have a standard way of specifying what you need with just a couple of clicks. And you've got a fleet that is managed in order to satisfy the demands, regardless of, you know, people or luggage requirements, whatever you need there. So.
Why wouldn't you just make just the two-person vehicle?
Oh, no, that's okay. You, go ahead. You can jump in, yeah. Well, why would I, well, finish your thought. Why wouldn't I, because maybe other people are thinking this too.
Why wouldn't you just have just the 1As and then as you need more things, just have
more of them?
Yeah.
Well, I think if you're talking about deploying like multiple 1As, then you've got the problem that there's like an overhead for each of the cars. It's got its own engine. It's got its own drag envelope. So the more you can put together into one unit, the better if you're all going to the same place. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. And of course, there could be car sharing or ride sharing too if you wanted to pick up someone along the way, but we didn't even get into that.
The typical fleet will actually have, you can serve a one person in a two person vehicle, so you'll actually have more two persons than you need, and so you should throw in an inefficiency factor for the times you use a larger vehicle.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
A number of people.
That's right. So I can definitely put in a, kind of a waste factor here, and I think we'd still be way ahead, but that's true. That's true. I have not done a full fleet optimization simulation yet, but that's coming.
Have you also gotten into the relative cost of replacing buses?
Yeah, see, so this was just a very, very kind of back of the envelope. I mean, it wasn't back of the envelope, but I didn't look into positional requirements. We did look at range of because there's issues if you're using a battery fleet, then you have to worry about how many trips can it make. But we didn't look, you're talking about position.
About urban, local
yeah.
Buses.
Yeah, no, we haven't done that yet. That's what we'd like
There's
to do next.
There's a fair bit of research in the literature on it, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it goes all the way. The extreme is a New York taxi, where that's 38% unoccupied.
Exactly.
Really bad. But that's because they cruise looking for
one. That's right.
Larry Burns' research was too optimistic. He suggests only 5% over miles.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe that.
Typically, you see 10 to 15% over miles in that particular
Great. Okay. Maybe I'll ask you for a reference for that, because it would be nice to be able to point to something well-researched. Yeah, I mean, I do think that a well-managed AV fleet might be able to do better, like than you say, than drivers looking around for rides that they need. And so they're not spending as much time cruising. But in the back, did you still have a question?
Yeah. So how do you take into account safety and comfort into this? Because almost by this argument, no one would buy a big screen TV. They would just buy a 13-inch TV because it's more energy.
Right. Well, that's a fair... I mean, I personally believe that in order to save as much money as possible on a commute, unless I just need more space because, you know, I've got stuff or I just like to stretch out or whatever, I would probably get the smallest car that fits my needs. Maybe it's a little bigger than what I've modeled here, but we did look at the case where what if everybody wanted a luxury vehicle and so they were buying essentially two sizes larger, so a one-person trip was using a three-person vehicle and so on. And that definitely blows up the... You know, it definitely blows up the energy usage. We calculate it's about 60% higher on average. But that 60% extra usage on top of a 94% reduction is like a 91% reduction or something. So it really doesn't eat into the total savings very much. I think I'll take your question, and then I'll move to the rest of the talk.
There are pretty detailed studies of vehicle sharing for Singapore and for Lisbon. They have about a 30%
Oh, yeah.
And, well, think about peak period. You're going to have a dominant flow. There's got to be empty backhaul. You can't just have everybody go. You're not going to have people going from workplaces to home during the morning peak.
Right.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. No, you're right. I think it's inevitable unless you have a network where there is no dominant flow where things would be. So there is going to be a loss there. Yeah, very, very fair. Okay, I have to go through this again. All right. So just kind of putting these factors together now, we get about a factor of two savings just going from today's gasoline engine to a 2030 gasoline engine. This is mainly because of the federal regs for this. Roughly another factor of two savings on a greenhouse gas basis switching to an electric vehicle in 2030, which is not much more efficient than an electric vehicle today, but it's a little bit more. If we can make the grid greener, basically follow California's lead, we could get up to another factor of two drop in greenhouse gas savings, but this isn't necessary to get the big savings that we're talking about. And then finally, a factor of two for what we call right sizing, what we just talked about. You put that all together, you get about 1/16th the energy use of today's vehicles, or a 94% savings. So if you take this one out, then it's an 87% savings. It's still very, very significant. And, you know, do you absolutely need autonomous vehicles to make this happen? Maybe not, because this is largely about sharing rides and using electric vehicles. But I believe that autonomous technology can strongly enable both of these trends and make it more more acceptable. Certainly in the near term, it can accelerate the adoption of the electric vehicle, and therefore I think it's really important to help bring this into reality. So I finally, I'm gonna show an analogy that I think might be apt. If conventional vehicles are like physical media, you can think of autonomous taxis like streaming media, right? On demand, exactly what you need, when you need it. And then it's a question of, you know, how long these are gonna last.
I know.
And earlier we were talking about muscle cars maybe becoming more popular once we have mostly AVs on the roads. But probably not everyone is going to buy this. Fair enough. All right. I want to just talk a little bit about battery range, because this could be a big deal, but I think we've mitigated the issue. So battery, right? So we've got an 80-mile battery. A lot of people worry about buying an electric vehicle today because they say, well, that's fine most of the time, but what if I want to go to Tahoe, or what if I want to do this? I can't buy a car that's electric because some of the time I'm not going to be able to make it, and the charging time is slow and so on. Well, if they're robot cars, it kind of matters less, because you only need that car for the few minutes or hour or whatever that you're in it, and it's the taxi company's problem to worry about recharging and repositioning it. So the average trip in the U.S. is only 10 miles. The average trip in New York City is only 2.6 miles. So this means that if you had an 80-mile Leaf battery, it's sufficient for 8 trips of a U.S. average or 31 New York City trips. It seems like there's plenty of capacity here to be able to satisfy a number of trips before that vehicle has to be taken offline for recharging. And we've also done the work of looking at, you know, peak periods using some New York City data to ask the question, you know, do all the vehicles have to be on the road at one time? And it looks like they don't, because that peak period is only about four to 6 hours long, and then there's a lull, and then there's the evening peak. And so you could imagine deploying, having most of the vehicles charged up and ready to go, they all get deployed, and then they get pulled off for recharging halfway through the day. And then you can have a minority, maybe 10 or 20% of them, that are not deployed during the peak time that can satisfy those kind of shoulder trips. Anyway, I have not done detailed simulations of how that would work, but I've done enough to think that it's probably not going to be a huge deal to take these things down for recharging during the day. And even if the battery capacity is diminished, either because it's running the air conditioning all the time or it's an older vehicle that doesn't have the same capacity as a new one, it just means that you have to recharge them more often. And this may not be adequate for certain kinds of trips because, you know, this is the average. So if you have a 60-mile trip, you're not going to deploy one of these older cars for that trip. The system should be smart enough to know that it needs to give the person a fully charged battery that can take them the full distance. And for trips longer than 80 miles, you know, maybe you would deploy a few gasoline vehicles for those purposes. You know, it should be a pretty flexible system. All right, so finally, what about battery life? This is the last topic I'll touch on. I think there's still a lot of work to be done to understand just how much capacity you have, especially at several hundred thousand miles, which is many thousands of cycles. But work that I have found that looked at extreme, a very wide range of battery conditions. And this is simulations. These are not, these are based on real data that was then put together into some heuristic formulas. The main driver seems to be, surprisingly, not depth of discharge, but the temperature that the battery is kept at during its duty cycle, and that makes a huge difference to how quickly the battery degrades. I'm not a battery expert, so I could be wrong about this, and I'd love to get your feedback, but what we found is that depending on whether this battery is kept between 15 and, or 60 degrees, it will degrade more or less quickly over its life. And what I have here is the full 5-year life of an autonomous taxi, 350,000 miles. And, you know, it's gotten down to about 65% of its original charge. It could be worse than that if the thermal management system isn't good or there's other problems with it, but there's still, you can use this at close to its full capacity for a long time before you need to think about replacing it. I just want to put up for full disclosure, I did get some recent Nissan Leaf data. This is in terms of their warrantied battery, 100,000 miles or 75% charge, and then I forget what this one is. These are significantly more pessimistic than these, so I'd love to know sort of what's going on there. Maybe this sort of ensures that you never get down there. I don't know. But anyway, even if it were sort of here, you can still imagine this running for a long time before you have to replace the battery. But the question is, if you replace the battery, then you're paying several thousand dollars, and is that going to blow your economics? So we wanted to make sure that we were on good ground there. So I envisioned this situation. So imagine that you're driving a car for a while and maybe you hit 150,000 miles and decide it's time to replace it. So you drop that battery out, but you get some money for it. Ah, that's the key. You get some money for it because this battery is not useless. It might still have 75% of its original charge capacity. There are other applications. Stationary electric storage is just one of them. It could just be a used battery for somebody less fortunate who needs to buy the cheapest battery possible. The point is that you get some payback for that, and then you pay for a brand new battery to put back in, and you're on your way. All right. So then you're down at 2 cycles, and you do this again. All right. And we're going along until the battery, until the vehicle's useful life is over, getting a little money back, paying more for a replacement. But then at the end of its life, You get to sell that final used battery, and you can actually come out break even if the economics work out right, right? So you buy three new batteries, but you sell four because you bought one at the beginning, and that's already factored into the economics.
What is your assumption for how long the vehicle is going to last?
Yes. 5 years. At 70,000 a year. I know what you're thinking. 350 is awfully long. So we did some research into this. It turns out that taxis are routinely driven for more than 5 years. I'm not really sure what's going on here, because the average life of a privately owned vehicle is only about 160 to 180, let's call it 200,000 miles. Now, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that many cars last far longer than that, but the taxis seem to routinely go further, and they are aging much more quickly, however.
But so they're also being rebuilt along the way.
They might be. You're right. See, so, okay. So I think, I mean, honestly, ultimately, if a car is being used this heavily, you'd probably want to build it a little different. So I acknowledge that, but... Yeah, so we assume that it would last 5 years, and then it's definitely done. Okay, but I just wanted to put this together and say, depending on how long you wait between intervals of replacement, this is you only have to get a certain fraction of the initial value back. And for instance, let's say that you replace it halfway through its life, so roughly, well, let's say at 175,000 miles, which is halfway through here. So now you're talking, you can still. As long as you get paid at least 50% of its initial value, then you can break even on this whole equation. But if my equations are right, you're still sort of down around 75% of its capacity, which means that you're able to give somebody a bargain. You're paying half and you're getting 3/4 of the capacity. So, Brad.
So when I researched this, I got a different conclusion, which is A, that battery swap is practical for taxis in a way it's not practical for ordinary users.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have battery swap, there's no problem with the 70% battery. You just don't send that vehicle on trips that are more than its capacity.
Right, exactly.
You actually don't need to sell the battery. In fact, you don't even need to sell the battery even if you don't have battery swap. It's just you have a little bit of extra capital wasted in the vehicles that sit in recharging for more intervals during the day. You can, of course, time that. The other thing that there's mm-hmm. a bigger front I'll talk about later, but the other thing that maybe you're missing is it's a very important number. About 55% of our miles and a significant number of our trips are less than 10 miles, and there's no highway involved in them.
Yes.
So actually, when you build vehicles that are not highway capable, you can do much better energy number than the numbers you use.
Right. Because they're slower overall, and therefore you can have much
slower,
smaller.
They're efficient because they're slower.
Right.
But they also don't weigh nearly as much. They don't have. Eventually, they even have less weight for safety, although you can't get away from that in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you look at Oliver Cutler's X-Prize winning car, for example, the Edison 2, he was able to get a car that couldn't do the crash test at about a third of the weight of today's vehicles already, even with our crash constraints.
Right.
And that car won with over 100 miles per gallon on liquid fuel and even better on hybrid.
Thank you. So that's really positive then. I mean, I'd like to, you know, one of the things we wanted to do was try to show that you could get these big savings even if you didn't take these other benefits into account, like extreme lightweighting and so on. But I really like that. Those inputs. Can I just get to my last slide, and then we can open it up completely? So the last question is, will people use these? And I don't have much to say here other than to say we have to know more and wait. But, you know, what if people think that these robots are evil? So I think, you know, one of the big unknowns is social acceptance. We hope that people are going to like them and that they're going to embrace them, but that could easily go either way, especially at first. So this initial rollout is very important. We have some indications that people are tentatively embracing of them, but that could really flip, especially if there's a fatality early on in the game. And finally, you know, this really came up in my interviews on this paper. Everybody wanted to know about all the jobs lost from the taxi drivers. And would they oppose it and so on? And I think that we need to think sensitively. I mean, this is a general problem for technology change. You invent something new that replaces human workers somewhere, and often not a lot of thought is given to where those people are going to go. But this could be a very visible issue as well, because the New York cabbie is like part of the American, you know, experience. So, so with that, this is just the summary. Three synergistic effects. that give you these big savings. High mileage favors efficient vehicles, such as battery electrics. You can deploy by the trip and be a lot smaller, and falling greenhouse gas emissions intensities can further amplify those savings. And then I'll just leave you finally with this image of a future of autonomous taxi travel, cheaper and much better on the environment. All right, that's it. Yep. Calling you to set.
Okay. Thanks again, Jeff.
Sure.
Let's, if I can get the questions into the mic. Okay. Steve, I'll come right back to you.
Sure. I draw back to your argon microsimulation where you're driving cycles.
Yeah.
So did you capture the effect that autonomous taxis will likely have different throttle characteristics and all?
Oh, good. I'm glad you asked that. We did not include that in our baseline effects here.
Yeah.
I mean, we really try to be very clean and say we don't need any extra benefits from autonomous technology in order to get these.
Yeah, I presume you use an EP like move profile or some detail.
We just use the standard highway and sort of urban.
I'm here to tell you, and you all know, that that's not how autonomous or automated vehicles will drive.
Right. So, sorry, say that last part again.
Not how, as you know, and you've acknowledged, we all know that.
Yes. They will drive much, much more efficiently than that.
You're saying that the smooth drive for acceleration and deceleration, as well as the lower speed, are dramatically.
You said it better than me, but yeah, that's right.
This gentleman in the blue shirt.
Also, the heat battery less.
Yeah, that's right.
In your cost model, you assumed a cost per ownership that seemed to be invariant to whether you're driving 12,000 miles a year or 70,000 miles a year, which means you're not accounting for the difference in the life of the vehicle. So I think you've put a really unfair penalty on the vehicles that are driving those shorter mileages. You really have to look at that as a fraction of the vehicle life that you're charging per year as
right.
the ownership cost.
So what you're saying is when you drive it 12,000 miles a year, you pay off the loan in 5 years, but you still have another 10 years of...
If you've got a vehicle that can go 350,000 miles and you've only driven 12 of them,
right.
you've only used up 12 350ths
right.
of its life. You haven't used 70 350ths of the life.
That is fair. But I will say that I don't expect a car that's only driving 12,000 miles a year to really go 350. I mean, it would be better if we had a complete apples to apples and we could...
Well, you could easily do that just by putting the larger fraction into that annual cost associated with the capital cost. That's what you really should do to make an apples to apples comparison.
Steve's correct. This is the big fly, but I know you later.
Oh, okay. All right. Fair.
So, but no, there is a win. The win comes if you can get the vehicle's engineer to last 350 or 400,000 miles. The average
right.
car in California is 190,000 miles over about 18 and a half years. In the United States, it's a little bit shorter. We haven't gotten as much salt here, so we get a little bit better. So the win is actually not the one you presented. The win is that the total depreciation is lower because you get more miles out of that vehicle. Out of its body, out of its battery, its
total depreciation. Oh, I see. In other words, the way you would count the economic value of that vehicle after so many years is that it's...
The vehicle costs $50,000 and goes 350,000 miles. The cost per mile is lower.
Sure.
With a small account for time value.
Right. So what you're saying is it's just the longevity of the vehicle itself that is the big economic win. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So some of these, a lot of these vehicle sharing calculations I've seen, and I'm not sure how you guys handle this, assume that there is no fuel used in getting to pick up the driver. You know, there's going to be a lot of empty miles where you're carrying no one, which isn't a problem with a manually driven or personally owned vehicle. What percentage of miles were empty miles in your calculations?
Yeah, so you're right. A couple of people had mentioned that earlier, I think Brad and one other person. I did not include an empty mile fraction in my calculations, and I probably should have. I guess I didn't have a good number to use, but I think that 30% or so would be a fine proxy for that. So that would hit the calculations a little bit, and it would bring up the average GHGs per mile. Yeah. But I think it's also highly dependent on the urban environment. I mean, maybe it's a number that's fairly invariant depending on where you are, but I suspect that places that have, all the people live here and downtown is there versus ones that are a little more networked, you'll get a different answer.
Also miss the parking safety.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Right, further benefits.
So you appeared to have calculated in vehicle efficiencies in this, but you don't appear to have calculated in battery improvements when you're talking about an 80-mile vehicle. And if you look at the Chevy Bolt that's going to be coming out with the 200-mile range because they have new cells from LG that are going to give them much better range.
Right.
If you're talking about a 2030 date, I said the Bolt.
Oh, sorry.
Bolt. Mm-hmm.
The 2030 date, I would expect potentially some significant battery advances that could change these calculations significantly.
Yeah, so it turns out the National Academy's data that I pretty much used for all of my economics was very conservative with the predicted cost of the battery. So its 2030 value is about where batteries actually are now. So you drop that a factor of two or something, and then it'll make the electric battery look even better. But am I missing something? You're talking about range also.
I'm talking about range as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could trade off, right? So you could say, well, I could make the range larger, or I could just make it cheaper and have an 80-mile range. I mean, I'm kind of agnostic as to exactly what range you need. The 80 was used as an example. I think, honestly, you may probably, well, I don't know where the optimum is. I think it's going to depend on a lot of factors. But
it impacts the time that your vehicle is sitting idle while charging.
Right.
All of the other workplace.
Right. And I'm sure that taxi companies would want those things to be idle as little as possible. But if you drive 70,000 miles a year, that's about 200 miles a day. And even if you're driving, I don't know, I mean, you'd have to drive like 10 miles an hour on average all the time in order for them to need to be on the road practically 24 hours. I mean, if you're driving on average faster than that, let's say 20 miles an hour, then it's only 10 hours a day that they need to be actually on the road. You can spend the other 14 hours charging. So I'm not convinced that you need to have a very fast turnaround for the charging. You can charge them two or three times a day, even if it's 3 or 4 hours per charge, and you can still meet your needs.
But electricity costs three times as much during the day, so there is
a reason. Okay. All right. Fair. Right. All right. Well, those things could, obviously significantly impact how you optimize that system. All right. You had your hand up, too, Mirka. Okay.
I was wondering, in your calculations where you say 90% reduction in greenhouse gases, did you model in the miles, all the trips that are above 80 miles, so that cannot be done electrically? Did you take that into account?
No, I didn't.
No, you did not.
It's a good point. Yeah, I was looking at averages, and you're right. It's an average with a long tail. My gut feeling is that those longer trips that could not use an 80-mile battery are going to be fairly small. You could also argue, well, you could just use a bigger battery for those and, still deal with it electrically. But these are the kinds of nuances that I think a more complete, model description would have to take into account.
Yeah. Maybe Elon Musk will take care of that. And I have another question here.
Another question? Okay. let's hope so.
Did you model the dropout of the cars? So, like, we have new cars coming out every year, right?
Yeah.
But there are still a bunch of cars that are 15 years old. There are a bunch of cars that there are even more cars that are 10 years old and that kind of thing. Did you model this slow dropout of the cars in your predictions?
See, I didn't, because this wasn't a stock simulation model. This was really just a direct substitution of, if instead of taking a ride in a privately owned vehicle, I took it in an autonomous taxi in 2030, what would be the comparative difference? What would be the change in greenhouse gas emissions for that trip or for that car, let's say? Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking about the average greenhouse gas emissions of the whole fleet, that then requires assumptions about how quickly are these being brought in the market and these other things you're talking about. And I didn't look at that on purpose, because I didn't want to have to say, oh, we're going to have 5%, in 2030, because then everybody's going to say, that's too aggressive, or that's not aggressive enough.
Yeah.
So I stayed away from that.
Yeah. So rather dangerous topic. So this is just for the new fleet that you'll be introducing. So that is part of the overall model that you'll be introducing.
So if this becomes the majority of cars, let's say in 2050, then it's possible that you could have this level of savings for the fleet as a whole. But it's just going to be a small increment in 2030. or whenever they're launched.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You had a question.
What does that work out to, cost per mile in 2030?
I want to say the autonomous vehicle is something like 30 cents a mile. And that assumes a fairly modest cost for the autonomous technology itself, but it's not zero. I think I used $5,000 as an adder on top of the regular vehicle cost. Yeah, and, you know, how much does this little tiny half-width vehicle cost? I really have no idea. I had to do a scaling analysis to see, you know, this versus a regular size four-seater.
They've already got, like, the Renault Twizy, say, $8,000 MSRP vehicle.
So. Right. Eight versus, like, what? 30 for the Leaf, something. So it actually falls much faster than the number of passengers anyway. So it could be even cheaper than that. I was conservative with the cost of the capital. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Just a comment. There's another very interesting aspect. So when I worked for Better Place, we were doing a lot of similar calculations with battery swapping, all of this. And as we're talking to utilities, we found out that the point in having a large number of batteries can help the utilities in manage their grid. So you can charge the EVs at night when there's wind energy, and sometimes the utilities have to pay money to get rid of it, in Denmark, for example. So you get money to take off the energy to the grid, so you get free electricity in your batteries.
Yeah.
And then during the day, like at 12 o'clock, when it's really hot outside, air conditions booming, there's a peak in the grid, you could use all those EVs to give electricity back to the grid and help the utilities manage the peak. And they were actually offering Better Place a lot of money to get that energy back. So give you free money at night and then pay you money to get it back during the day.
Sounds like a great business
case. And that's another one that will help you reduce greenhouse gas emissions and bring your total cost down.
Right. So I can see that if you have these kinds of credits, you know, and the other savings that we've talked about, the cost of getting around could become extremely cheap. And I mean, it just gets me very excited to think about how much better we could have it than the system we have today. So other, yeah.
Yeah, what was your estimate for the price of gas in 2030?
So it's driven by the price of oil. EIA is very conservative, so they tend to be close to what it is today. I think there was then maybe like a dollar or two to either side of that. So maybe the high point was six. I could have looked at even more pessimistic cases, but I just wanted to stick with, you know, sort of government research sources and not make things up. Yeah.
Are you looking now beyond just the taxi services and general people transport to kind of movement of goods and those types of things, and then delivery and that? And it also seems like in manufacturing plants, you know, they start getting to the point where they can actually shut down the plant, turn off the air conditioning, and it's just robots in there and that type of stuff. That's what's coming. And I think in a pretty rapid way. It seems like the cumulative effect of that entire body of what the impact is going to be for autonomous technologies is going to be profound. Maybe the double, like what you're showing here. So
can you stick around a little after? I'd like to talk with you just a few more minutes on that. Yeah, no, I haven't looked at any of that yet, and that's quite interesting to me. Yeah.
It looks like the large majority of the savings that you're showing are because of the electric propulsion, not because of the automation. Did you do sort of a control study to say, well, what if it's just a manually driven electric vehicle of that category that's providing the taxi service?
Right.
So you can separate out how much you're actually gaining because of the automation technology.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair question. I didn't do a control study. I actually was very curious what EIA thought the electric penetration would be in 2030, and I was floored to find it was like nothing. It was like 1%, something like that. But I can tell you right off, I mean, if you're driving an autonomous normal size, I mean, sorry, if you're driving an electric normal size taxi in 2030, the only advantage of it being autonomous then would be the factor of two, roughly, from having a smaller vehicle, plus whatever other autonomous savings that you have from like the smooth braking, acceleration, et cetera. So you're absolutely right. It's mostly going to the electric.
But it's not going to be that much smaller because it's just a difference of occupancy of one, right? Whether you have the driver or whether you don't have the driver.
Oh, I see. You're thinking of like a taxi driver driving like a two-seat with a single seat.
Yeah, with
behind.
A single passenger in the back.
Hmm. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Yep. Things could be, yeah.
problem, Steve, is nobody buys those vehicles.
Yeah. I was going to say, this is because they can only pick up a single.
Because you said there's only one, so you have the opportunity to deliver a small vehicle.
But it's only because you fantasize that vehicle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the questions of why they don't have little single passenger taxis now, I mean, that's a good question. It's like, well, because I could get a party of two or three, and so they want the optionality when it's a person's living. Robot doesn't really care. It's more of a fleet profit.
So the problem is that, Uber, for example, they could start deploying such vehicles if such vehicles were readily available, which they're not yet.
Yeah.
And they could know how many people are coming. Uber doesn't ask you how many people in the vehicle, so it could ask that. It resists asking that. The problem is that the Uber drivers would not want to limit their options in this way unless they had a financial incentive to do so.
Exactly.
So the typical cost of an Uber today, they typically run you about $1. UberX typically runs about $1.20 per mile, about $14 an hour for the driver. Pretty equivalent factors, even more in Los Angeles. So it's not economic for human-driven taxis to drive in these vehicles.
Right.
But it's definitely very economic to offer people a cheaper, lighter-weight vehicle if there's not going to be anyone else, no human time involved.
Exactly. Yep.
But just a question, isn't it around regulation? Because, I mean,
that business model works in Thailand, for instance, right now. So,
yeah.
You know, if the slow vehicles coming in, right? I mean, they are so much cheaper than the big ones, so then the economy can just rise as soon as they come in. So,
it's not another question. I mean, these...
That could shift.
Half of vehicles have some other problems. Their stance is very narrow, so therefore they actually can't take corners nearly as quickly as regular vehicles. People are resistant to that. If you have a vehicle that's not going on the highway and not going above a certain speed, you can have a narrow stance vehicle. You want a wide stance if you're going to be driving over a broad set of road circumstances, which is, again, why people. There's a vehicle called the Tango, which looks like that's for sale. Sergey has one. If O'Neill were to complain, try it out. But basically keeps itself stable by having a pile of lead in the bottom. It still feels very weird to drive.
Yeah, I bet it does. I mean, this, I have to say, this is very weird because we're so unused to having these little narrow vehicles. But, you know, from an engineering point of view, it makes total sense.
In Europe, they're more common. There's also a lot of research on vehicles at bank. Four-wheeled vehicles at bank are much more common here in Europe than they are. There's also a vehicle that is being made in Berkeley called the Lit C1, which uses a gyroscope to run on two wheels. And on two wheels, actually, you no longer have the problem banking.
Yes. You can just leave. Yeah, exactly. The questions?
Okay, any more questions? Probably have time for one or two more. Dan?
So you mentioned something that I've been thinking about. You mentioned that, you know, we could really reduce the cost per mile of driving. But if you look at the options available to car buyers today, very few people buy the lowest cost for driving. They'll buy cars that cost many times, you know, that for other reasons. And I think that those other reasons, which may be aspirational or maybe, you know, luxury goods, are not captured in something like this. And how do those affect, you know, your models, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, here, I'm not sure I can say anything other than my opinion about it, which is, I think that if a person is only using this system to get around and they don't actually own it, you're going to have a very different set of values. I mean, you might decide, you might be a higher-end client who decides that he likes driving around in the shiny, always clean, you know, premium taxi that's also bigger. And yeah, that person might be driving what we would consider a two- or three-person car all the time. I'm sure there will be some market differentiation there. But my instinct is that this becomes a very utilitarian service. And of course, there's going to be markups for the owner and so on. But you put all those other advantages together, and it's still going to be a lot cheaper than running a private vehicle that's just idle most of the time.
I think that's a great point, actually, because you're going to be able to amortize the cost of these vehicles over time.
Right.
The cost to make it so that it's actually luxury just from the outset, even for the, you know, common man, is actually not that expensive.
Probably
so
not.
It
right.
makes a lot of sense to just start there, sort of where everything is almost a black car service.
And then go down market as needed. Yep. Yeah.
Except you have to replace the interior every 60,000 miles or so.
Yeah, it might add up a little bit, yeah. You get extra thick leather cuts so that lasts longer.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and end there. Again, another round of applause. Thank you very much, Chef. one more very important thing. For the publication of your next paper, you can be wearing this shirt, the Nissan shirt.
All right, so, I will. Thank
thanks
you.
Again.
Thank you.
Great. Appreciate it, Jay.
Okay, sure. Sorry. My contacts, if anyone wants to get in touch with me. Sorry.
Well, 79 degrees, it's too hot.
Yeah, it's all right.
I mean, my shirt is a little wet.
Yeah. So it's actually, I learned this is the hottest corner.
Oh, really? Thanks,
a lot
thanks
cooler
that.
Back there, yeah.
Okay. Hi.
That was a fantastic guest.
Oh, thank you.
Very brave.
Yeah, I got a little flack.